This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Others who are knowledgeable on some of the emerging whistleblowers and what they have to tell us about what we have signed off on tacitly by agreeing and not stand by agreeing to be governed by the people who do indulge and engage in this type of activity. This has been our Cascadia for Monday, July 1st. Kathleen Stevenson engineered the show today. Kathleen's also, of course, KBOOM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. A few weeks ago, we ran a Locus Focus episode called Cows Save the Planet, in which my guest promoted a theory that soil health can be drastically improved through rotational grazing of cattle and doubling the size of cattle herds in the American West. As soon as I announced the show, I received some strong responses from Oregon scientists whose research proves this theory wrong. This morning, we talk with one of these scientists, Ashland-based ecologist Dominic Della Sala, about the future of federal lands in the Pacific Northwest. As he said to me, carbon, water, and wildlife. We'll not only talk about the fallacy of increased grazing on public lands, but also the impacts of logging and other practices that put these fragile landscapes at risk. Dominic is the president and chief scientist at the Geos Institute in Ashland, Oregon, whose mission is to use science to help people predict, reduce, and prepare for climate change. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hey, thanks a lot, Barbara, for having me on the show again.
Well, it's great to have you on. And I want to start, actually, by talking about what inspired you to email me as soon as you received the notice of the show I was doing called Cows Save the Planet to raise your concerns about this particular theory about rotational grazing and why you thought it was such an important thing to object to.
Yeah, you bet. Well, kind of in a nutshell, when I saw the announcement, my immediate reaction was, this is a bunch of bull, pun intended, and I wanted to look deeper into it in terms of what the author was saying and also how they cite some of Alan Savory's work, which also has some problems, that I thought it would be good for your listeners to hear an alternative position on this that has some more scientific backing to it.
So we're going to, let's actually start by talking a little bit with that, and then we'll move on to some of the wider issues, particularly about how climate change is causing a whole set of new challenges for protecting public lands. But let's talk about Alan Savory's theories, and the book actually spends very little time with cows, which I thought it was unfortunate she named the book Cows Save the Planet, because there were some other techniques about soil health and restoration that were actually quite valid. But when I did question her during the show about some of the questions that are raised about Alan Savory, she was pretty defensive and like, well, people tell me it works. So what is it that Alan Savory's telling farmers, particularly, well, I guess in South Africa is where he's from, so these were theories he first tried to put into practice in Africa and then exported to the United States?
That there's no question that rotational grazing in places can be an improvement over, you know, just having cows hang out in one area over short periods of time. So you want to move cows around. There are really good examples of landowners doing this. TNC, the Nature Conservancy, has some good examples of reducing the impacts by moving cows around. But I think it's a bit of a stretch to take it the further step in thinking that this is going to save the planet from climate change, because it fails to take into consideration the fact that livestock are definitely a big footprint on the planet, if you will. And when you look at the sources of greenhouse gas pollution, cattle on a global level account for about 18% of all the world's greenhouse gas pollution. It's right up there with deforestation. And in the tropics like Brazil, it's associated with deforestation because you have slash and burn agriculture, which takes these incredibly rich rainforests and converts them into a big ag field, and all that carbon, a lot of that carbon goes up to the atmosphere. Then you introduce cattle, which are off-gassing methane, which is much worse than carbon dioxide in absorbing heat, and you've got this kind of cycle going on in the tropics. So the claim that this is going to save the planet is just a specious claim that doesn't have a lot of scientific backing to it.
Well, actually, in the beginning of her book, she has all these myths that she's busting, and one of them is that cows are a serious producer of methane gas. And so I wonder, is there science that argues that cows produce a lot of methane? It seems intuitive that they might, because if one spends much time around cattle, they recognize that they fart a lot.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering why proponents of rotational grazing or holistic range management or whatever it's called, why they argue that cows, in fact, do not produce very much methane.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like anything else. It really depends. So if you're talking about a feedlot, and anybody that's driven by the feedlots in Nebraska or some of the, you know, eastern Oregon, eastern Washington feedlots, you can smell those things miles away. And some of the towns that live in this are inundated by the smell of livestock. So that's part of the problem with methane being off-gassed from those feedlots. So it's more of a problem in feedlots than if you're doing rotational grazing. But to dismiss it as not being a global contributor of greenhouse gas pollution is just, it's not correct.
Well, the other concern that I had when I was reading the book and interviewing the author was the other impacts that cattle grazing has on public lands. And she's visited a place in North Dakota where this guy was using rotational grazing and supposedly really restoring the health of his soil. But I'm thinking about all these places I've gone hiking in eastern Oregon and eastern Washington that are heavily grazed. And I didn't realize until many years later, with the help actually of some of the photographs and some of your papers, of understanding how transformed the landscape has become through grazing. So let's talk about some of the other impacts besides producing greenhouse gases that are the result of the large-scale grazing in public lands that already goes on.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good science on this part, and it's well documented that livestock can alter the health of a riparian or streamside system, especially the way the channel works its way downslope, and all kinds of impact from compaction of soils, from, you know, just cows defecating in streams. You know, when I was a kid, I used to be able to put my canteen in most of the streams that I was hiking in. But you do that today, and you've got to be wary of Giardia problems. So you've got water quality issues. You've got how the cattle adversely impact the stream banks, the loss of vegetation along the streams, and then the accompanying erosion that takes place. The compaction of soils, the introduction of invasive plants that will hitch a ride, so to speak, on cows as they're moving across the landscape. All of these changes are happening at a phenomenal scale. When you look at the impacts, the stressors that we're putting on public lands, cattle by far impact more of the landscape than the footprint from logging and fires combined. So this is a impact that's not on a lot of people's radar, because it seems like it's you know, no big deal. But when you put it together, this is the largest impact on federal lands that's out on the landscape in western U.S.
Well, let's describe the difference. Let's say, let's imagine a stream in some little canyon in eastern Oregon that is has had no contact with cattle, and compare that with a stream which is heavily impacted by cattle. What would be the visual difference between the two?
Yeah, if you have a lot of livestock use along the streams, and this is where a lot of it occurs, because cows want the shade and they want the water. And these riparian areas also have the highest concentration of wildlife, especially in places that are, you know, otherwise dry environments. You get a big oasis of wildlife activity along those stream banks. And so when the cows come through, they more or less pretty much hammer the stream banks, and the stream banks start eroding into the creeks, and it causes all kind of siltation problems. But if you take the livestock off the land and you either fence the area or have cattle exclusion zones, within about a decade, you start to get willow that comes back into the streams. Beavers will come back in. All kinds of different wildlife will be nesting in the increasing shrub layer. You get shading and cooling of the stream for trout and overall water quality improvements. There are decades of research on this, before and after photos documenting how the riparian areas will recover. And sometimes it takes them a long time to do so. If you're in very arid regions where you're mostly concerned about the cryptobiotic crusts, these very fragile soil layers that are living layers of the soil, can take, you know, several decades to recover. But without cows on the landscape, eventually they will come back.
Well, often proponents of rotational grazing, we make references to ungulates, wild hoofed animals that have historically lived on these landscapes, and that this method of grazing is a way to replicate the way that bison would would live on and graze on the landscape, or elk. And I'm wondering, what issues do you have with using the ungulate model as an example of why rotational grazing is a good thing?
Well, you still have cows in the streams. And so you're going to congregate livestock in the streams, no matter how much rotational moving around of the livestock you're going to do. They're eventually going to go into the stream areas because the shade and the water is there. So it's still going to have an impact. You may be able to reduce that impact, but it's still measurable and something that can be documented compared to a site that has not had cattle use.
But I've also heard some concerns about the problems like with overpopulation of elk. And I guess the other part that I was wondering about was bison were used as an example by Alan Savory of, you know, how ungulates can coexist with the grass landscape and actually be very beneficial for it. But what's the difference between the lands where bison roamed and running cattle in eastern Washington and Oregon?
Right. Well, in a lot of places, the model just doesn't work. It breaks down because we haven't had bison. And the ecosystems and places that haven't experienced large ungulates like that did not evolve with large ungulates on the landscape. So when you introduce cattle in those areas, then, you know, the plants are not equipped to handle that kind of intense grazing, even if you move cows around. Again, you can reduce the footprint, but it's still a detectable footprint and having measurable impacts on the stream and on water quality, because you're still getting those animals congregated in those areas. Now, another thing that's missing from the western landscapes, most of them, is the top predators that would have been moving these animals around just by their presence and also culling the herds. So we don't have wolves and grizzly bears like we did on western landscapes, with the exception of the Rockies. And so you're still going to get these animals that are stuck in one place because they don't have to worry about predators.
Well, I've also seen some really interesting photographs of areas in Washington where wolves are being reintroduced, but it's looking at the damage that the elk have done, because the elk population has gotten so large, and there was this area where they fenced it off, and so the elk could not get to this one bit of the woods, and it had a totally different ecosystem than the rest of the area where the elk were grazing. So what are some of the downsides of having too many elk?
Same thing. You're going to impact the landscape, especially the riparian areas. You'll impact aspen development along the stream banks, willow development. A lot of plants that occur in the riparian zone are going to be hit pretty hard by intense browsing, whether you're talking about high concentrations of elk, which would be above kind of the background level if you had predators in the system, or if you're talking about too many cows on the landscape, you're going to have pretty much similar impacts to that system because it just didn't evolve with that kind of intense grazing pressure.
Well, this morning we're talking with Dominic Della Sala, who is with the Geos Institute in Ashland. And Dominic, I used to think of you as being a forest ecologist, but it sounds like you've been branching out into other areas of ecology in terms of the way you're looking at the world. So would you say that now your primary focus is on dealing with climate change?
Yeah, I think so. And there are, you know, like, there's no bigger impact on the planet that we're having right now than climate change. And so it affects all ecosystems, particularly forest and grasslands. So you're kind of looking at the top-down driver, if you will, of ecosystem change and climate change. And so to understand that, I have to move into the realm of climate change and then look at the feedbacks to how it impacts our drinking water and, you know, forests that should be part of the solution rather than the problem if we manage them to be that way.
Well, this is probably a very good week to be talking about climate change. I understand it was 128 degrees in Death Valley yesterday.
Yep, and it's been in the triple digits down here in southern Oregon, and a very hot period for our July weather. Not unusual, but we'll see what happens if it, you know, if we have an unusually long summertime. But the rest of the U.S. had the hottest temperatures on record last year, so we'll see if that pattern continues.
Well, actually, last year we escaped from that, but this summer it may be a different story. I have a little anecdote. I actually got caught. I had my first major climate change of plans. Last week I was on my way up to Calgary, Alberta, to do some interviewing for a radio documentary I'm doing, and I was in Missoula and heard the word that Calgary was underwater, and I talked to one of my contacts there, and he was referring to it. I'm trying to remember what he said. It was microclimate disturbance, I think. I'm not exactly sure what you probably know what that phrase is, but he was saying this was a very clearly a climate change event. It was the worst flood they'd ever had in history, and Calgary's not a place where you think that they have a lot of catastrophic floods. And it really made me think about, because the project I'm doing is about tar sands and climate change, and thinking this is really upon us. And so I was watching from afar the flooding of this area I couldn't get to, and thinking this is a very graphic example of how things are really changing. And it's one thing to be aware of Pacific Atoll, the islands that are disappearing, but to have a place so far inland with a rather puny river running through it causing so much havoc makes you realize that we're really in a different time now.
We are. It's the time of global climate weirding, I would call it. And if you look at the data from 2012, I actually was wrong before. It's the second hottest year on record. And it amounted, in terms of total damages, $110 billion in storm-related and fire-related damages that can be attributed to climate. And the costs keep going up every single year. And it's because we've got runaway climate change that we're experiencing right now and need to do something proactive while we still have time.
Well, let's talk about the forests as both in terms of how they're endangered by climate change and how they may be our best hedge against the worst effects of climate change if we start taking care of them better.
Right. And, you know, forests really are what's cleansing the air we breathe and producing the drinking water that we need. If you look at forests, you know, trees make water and they make oxygen. And we can be using them, enlisting them in the battle against climate change if we were able to do our job of conserving what they're doing for us. And what I mean by that is if you look at the coastal rainforests, for instance, that occur from the California redwoods all the way up to the Olympic Peninsula into British Columbia and Alaska, those are some of the most carbon-dense forests on the planet. They are soaking up massive amounts of carbon dioxide through the process of photosynthesis, if you remember your high school biology class, and they hang on to that carbon in their massive tree trunks, their soils, and the surrounding vegetation. So they're helping to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, hanging on to it for centuries in these incredibly big ancient trees. And when we cut those forests down, we release carbon dioxide as a global warming pollution. And just to give you an example of this, if you take the amount of carbon that's stored in the coastal rainforest of Oregon alone, and you do some back-of-the-napkin calculations in terms of what that represents, those forests are storing the carbon dioxide equivalents of over 38 times Oregon's greenhouse gas pollution. That's a phenomenal amount of carbon that's being tied up in those coastal rainforests. This is why we're saying enlist them in the battle against climate change by conserving these incredibly carbon-dense rainforests that are helping us deal with climate change.
I have this image as you're talking. I was watching this movie last night called Petropolis, which is basically a visual aerial views of the Alberta tar sands operations in northeastern Alberta. And they go from showing these untouched boreal forests, and then they go into move into the area which has been completely ravaged by strip mining and this incredible industrial complex. I guess it's the size, it's ultimately going to be the size of Florida, but right now I think it's only the size of England. And there's all these images of gas flaring, and just at the war, you just look at this and this looks like this incredible carbon emission pit. And I think that the value, and it really made me question, what kind of values do we have where we just cut down immense forests, whether they're boreal forests or temperate rainforests or Amazonian rainforests, and replace them with carbon emitters? And are you concerned that this kind of mindset is here in Oregon as well as up in Alberta?
Yeah, I think so, and it's unfortunate that we live in a time where we have a global tragedy of the commons that is happening, and this is the term that George Hardin introduced in 1968 in Science magazine, that everybody wants the resource, but nobody's willing to put in what's necessary to steward the resource. So we are on a planet of takers rather than leavers, if you will, of some of these important critical ecosystem benefits that we get, like clean air and clean water. We have undervalued them because there's this perception that they're just infinite. They're going to go on forever. So what we need to do is we've got to flip it to being on a planet where we're part of an atmospheric or a climate commons, where we're stewarding the planet's resources in a way that is, you know, conserving forests for the values that they provide us, like clean air and absorbing our carbon dioxide and giving us clean water.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the biggest challenges that we're facing here in the Northwest in protecting our wildlands and our forests. And let's start with the ONC lands, which we heard a lot about in the news over the last year.
Yeah, it's a subset of Bureau of Land Management lands that's mostly in western Oregon. And there's a lot of really important ecosystem benefits coming from those forests. They're habitat for salmon, including the federally listed coho salmon. They're giving us clean air and hanging on to carbon. Some of the examples that I gave earlier in regards to the amount of carbon dioxide taken out of those at the atmosphere by those mature forests. And also what we found with a new mapping project is a lot of those watersheds contain the intake for drinking water supplies. And with clear-cut logging upstream of those intake sources, we're going to see increased sedimentation in those watersheds if the proposals go forward to increase logging on those ONC lands. We're going to see, you know, the public water utilities having to do more and pay more to keep sediment out of the streams.
Now, those lands, they were originally railroad lands, is that correct? And I also had the impression that they were lands that at some point were considered to be timber lands as opposed to be lands that you keep in a public trust, or as you talk about, a carbon trust.
Yeah, so we're talking about, you know, going back into the late 1800s, there's a long history here of how these lands have exchanged hands a couple of times. Then you had the 1937 ONC Act, which said, yeah, they're to be managed for a sustained yield of timber, provided that you protect them for their watershed values. So even in 1937, Congress had the wisdom to strike balance in terms of how those lands are to be managed. And what's happening now is there's an effort to tilt that balance towards increased logging, and the footprint of that logging increase could be particularly problematic for our drinking water supplies.
Now, what does ONC stand for?
Oregon and California Railroad Lands.
So what, I mean, you talk about the need to basically lock up these lands as a carbon trust. What do you mean by that? And what, because that seems to go against or opposed to what DeFazio and other parts of the Oregon delegation, I think with the notable exception of Earl Blumenauer and Suzanne Bonamici, everybody else in the congressional delegation is kind of promoting this plan to log more. So what's the difference between having a timber trust and having a carbon trust?
Yeah, you bet. First of all, a carbon trust would seek to optimize the amount of carbon that's in those forests, not maximize. And there's a difference in that optimizing carbon would be taking into consideration a lot of the other values and benefits that these forests provide, including water and wildlife habitat and salmon habitat and recreational values. That's what we should be managing those forests for as their predominant use. That doesn't mean that we can't have jobs or we can't be doing restoration on those forests. If we're optimizing carbon, we can still do thinning in forests that need thinning from a fire prevention or a fire risk reduction standpoint, especially the plantations that need a lot of work and could provide jobs to communities. So that's the difference. It's, you know, we're looking at optimizing, whereas the congressional proposals are looking at maximizing the amount of timber coming off those lands with pretty heavy consequences to clean water, salmon, and old forests.
Well, let's talk a little bit about thinning, because that's also kind of controversial. And what kind of thinning would you propose as opposed to some of the other thinning proposals that are on the table?
You know, I think that there's pretty good science that shows when you thin in a plantation, you can do a couple of things. You can speed up the process by which that forest over time will develop old forest characteristics, because we have so few old forests left in the Pacific Northwest. So we want to get them on a speedy conveyor belt so they become older forests quicker, and thinning can help with that. And also, you want to take care of places around where people live to reduce the risk of fire that will impact the so-called wildland-urban interface. So I think that's where a lot of the thinning could be concentrated to deal with some of the issues that communities face living in the Northwest and being in fire habitat.
But what are some of the other proposals for thinning? Because there's, I think, a concept of maybe you'd call it commercial thinning, where the boundaries get a little bit blurrier about what trees are actually going to be marked for cutting?
Yeah, there are all kinds of proposals that are being offered, including one type of new forestry that it's being called ecological forestry. But there's a lot of problems with how that's being proposed and implemented, for instance, on the BLM lands. They are talking about variable retention, regeneration harvest. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, I was reading your paper. What does that mean?
It's basically a modified clear cut. And so what they will do is either they'll look at a mature forest or a plantation. They'll go in and they'll basically clear cut it and leave trees either in clumps or dispersed. But the trees that they leave behind most often are little whip trees that probably are going to be blown down, especially if they're in areas with a lot of wind velocity. So they have very limited wildlife benefits. And, you know, when you look at it, it looks, it smells, and it feels like a clear cut.
So what's the rationale? I mean, how they say that, I mean, I first of all, like that it's called ecological forestry, which is, I guess, kind of like BP referring to themselves as a green company.
Right.
But I mean, what is the rationale? I mean, are they responding to the fact that clear cuts are now have a bad name, and so they're just trying to rebrand it? Or is there some kind of actual difference between that kind of logging and just out-and-out clear cutting?
Well, I think the main rationale behind it is everyone's looking for increasing timber volume on these lands that have a history of being overcut. We just can't squeeze much more out of these forests without having a very large ecological footprint. And so they're looking for other ways to increase timber volume and call it something different. And by leaving a few trees behind in a clear cut, you can get away with calling it something other than a clear cut, but ecologically speaking, when you go into those areas, they look very much and function very much like a clear cut.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Ashland ecologist Dominic Della Sella, and we're talking about the pressures and challenges of protecting our public forests and wildlands, particularly in the face of climate change. So I want to talk now about what are some of the particular stresses on our public lands because of climate change. I mean, right now there's like really horrific fires burning in Arizona for a change. Let's talk a little bit about some of the impacts that we're seeing and having to rethink the way we're going to approach maintaining and protecting our national forests.
Sure. For millennia, the climate has changed across the planet many, many times. The difference being that when we've had either increasing or decreasing sea levels and other climate change events like the melting or accumulation of glacial ice over long periods of geological history, wildlife have been able to adapt to those changes because they've been able to move across an otherwise permeable landscape. There weren't cities in the way, there weren't clear cuts out there to create inhospitable areas. So with this climate change event that we're witnessing, it's unprecedented in terms of the scale and the pace at which this is happening on top of a planet that is exceeding its natural resource capacity through population explosion and unabated natural resource consumption. And so the more we take out of the planet's forests and wetlands, the more difficult it becomes for wildlife and us to coexist and adapt to these changes that are taking place. Roads, clear cuts, and other types of human footprints on the landscape are only going to make it more difficult for wildlife to adapt to the conditions and for us. I was reading something the other day that most of the world's largest cities live within 50 kilometers of the sea, of the coast. And with all the current sea level rise projections being anywhere from a half a meter to 3+ meters, by the end of the century, we're talking about major shifts in human demographics that we're going to be entering into in this century. And so we've really got to be prepared for that. One way to do it is to make sure that you're protecting coastal mangroves and coastal wetlands, because that's going to be your barrier against storm surge and sea level rise.
So do you see any kind of way out of this? Is what kinds of actions would you see that communities need to be taking right now to both protect themselves, the built environment, but also the wild environment?
Right, and there's a lot of things we could be doing, and I was encouraged this week when President Obama had his climate change speech and mentioned a lot of the different initiatives that the administration's going to be launching into to recognize the value that our forests provide in maintaining carbon and water, and also seeking to help communities that are working proactively to get ready for climate change. And my organization does a lot of that kind of work with communities, so we were very happy to see that in the president's speech. And the way it could be done is through just bottom-up community planning for climate change. If you live in an area that's going to experience floods, then you can do more to protect your landscape by making sure that your forested slopes remain that way, because if you cut down those trees, you're just going to make the flooding worse. And I already mentioned the importance of wetlands and as a barrier against sea level rise, and there's all kinds of work that communities are doing all over the U.S. right now, bottom up at the grassroots level, to get ready for climate change. You can get that information, you know, this is self-promotional here, by getting on my our website and into the Google search image and typing climatewise.org, and
right,
you'll see a whole bunch of different ways communities can get ready.
So what is your website?
Climatewise.org is the name of the program that GEOS Institute has up and running with communities around the U.S. right now.
Well, we'll put a link on that to our website.
And great.
If you could email me the link, that will help jog my memory when I get home.
You bet.
Well, it was interesting after Hurricane Sandy last fall to I read and heard about a number of proposals in New York to basically re-green a lot of the areas around New York City, which used to be, you know, wide tidal marshes and all kinds of wetlands that have all been built on and filled. And some, actually, one of the big ones is actually the largest landfill probably in the eastern United States. So I don't know how far any of that has gone, if people in New York are really thinking about re-greening the Battery in Lower Manhattan and turning Lower Manhattan into a bunch of different tidal marshes. But I wonder if you think that this is actually something practical that cities the size of New York can do, or San Francisco is another case where they've just been building into the bay. I mean, I think the entire San Francisco International Airport is actually in the bay, and it's just been filled.
Right, yeah.
And so, do you know of actual plans to like make the bay bigger again, or to make the New York Harbor extended to more of its historic areas and sort of take out the buildings that are already there?
I don't, but I have seen some of the early planning that New York City is going through right now. It's expensive, but you know, you either pay up front in terms of prevention, or you pay later on in terms of damages. As I mentioned earlier on in the show, we had, you know, a record in terms of $110 billion in losses from, you know, superstorms like Sandy. So I think an ounce of prevention here is definitely worth it. And I'm encouraged by the discussion that's happening in New York City to, you know, hang on and restore more of their coastal wetlands, because they see the value in terms of having a natural barrier against sea level rise and storms and storm surge.
Actually, I get a caller who has a comment, and this kind of takes us back to the importance of trees again. And it's almost, this is like a no-brainer. The caller says that Cook Underwood area, there's been a lot of light clear cutting there, and now it's much hotter on the road. And that is like one of the obvious things that trees provide is shade. But in terms of larger climate issues, do you think that cutting down lots of trees, or even lightly, as they say, light clear cutting, has an impact on how hot the ambient air and soil is?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great observation. And anybody that goes out hiking knows that you don't want to be hiking in a clear cut on any day, except, you know, whether if it's really snowy and cold that day. You want to be inside the forest, because it's like outdoor air conditioning. And there is a definite measurable heat island effect that happens not only in clear cuts, but also in urban areas. And there's been all kinds of studies documenting the importance of urban forest in reducing that heat island effect. And, you know, I've been to a lot of cities that don't have, you know, a lot of trees like Portland and Seattle do, and it's a heck of a lot hotter in those heat islands than in places that do hang on to their tree cover. And the same thing goes for, you know, being outside in nature. It's just brutal being in a clear cut in the middle of July or August in comparison to being inside the moister and cooler mature and old-growth forest.
But I think there's a fallacy, isn't there, in equating heat islands with climate change, that they're not directly linked, though I think with climate change, you might have the impact of heat islands might become a little bit more extreme.
That's right. And it certainly helps by having that cooling effect of having an urban forestry environment, as well as having the beautification of just having a tree-friendly city.
And then, of course, all the carbon dioxide that is sucked up and all the oxygen that's emitted.
Right.
So now that we're heading towards fire season and we are heading towards the hottest days of the summer, what are some of your concerns as far as the challenges facing the forests around us and what we need to be doing in the near future?
Yeah, my concerns is that we're going to let the fire issue continue to get in the way of good ecological science, and that forests are going to burn. They have burned for millennia. and they're going to continue to burn regardless of what we do to them. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't do thinning, particularly around where people live. The best way you can prepare and reduce the risk of a forest fire is to have your individual house become fire wise. And there's all kinds of information on the web about how to prepare for, you know, fires if you live in the wildland-urban interface to reduce that risk. That's where we should be putting the bulk of federal resources, working with private landowners to reduce their risk of forest fire, because, you know, we live in fire habitat and the forests are going to burn at some point.
Actually, I was visiting this beautiful house that's being remodeled in the woods outside of Missoula last week, and there's ponderosa pines growing all around, and everybody's admiring this beautiful job they're doing in the house and the beautiful location. And I actually felt like I was channeling you, and I said, what kind of precautions are you taking about fire? Don't you think these trees are a little close to your house? And one of the people who lived there said, yeah, I guess they're supposed to be 30 feet away from the house. And the trees, you know, are like feet away from them. And I'm wondering, what do you say to somebody who is living in this gorgeous setting, you know, surrounded by ponderosa pine, about thinking about fire and how to protect their house? As opposed to just thinking, well, I guess I'll grab my computer and run. My computer, my cats, and my dog and run.
Well, I mean, even in that situation, took a site visit, I might suggest things like pruning the lower branches to make sure that they don't come in contact with the structure, make sure that there isn't a way for fire to be carried along the ground and then to hit the tree and run up to the crown, make sure that the roof of that house is built with fire-resistant material, make sure that there aren't any of the shrubs that are flammable surrounding the dwelling or any firewood that's left on the deck. So there are other precautions that can be taken, even in that situation, to reduce the risk.
Well, actually, we were sitting here. It was a very cool evening, and it had been raining in Missoula all week. And so she was clearing all of the underbrush and all kinds of flammable material, and that was what our fire was all night. So that part of the fire safety, she was doing a good job.
That's good to hear.
I hope her house doesn't burn down. It's a very nice place. Well, Dominic, it's really great to talk with you again. And we will stay in touch. And I'll definitely, if you email me your web link, I'll stick it on the KBOO website this afternoon.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks a lot.
Sure. We've been talking with ecologist Dominic Della Sala, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locustfocus. Next week, my guest will be Eric Azadorian, one of the editors of the new State of the World 2013 book, Is Sustainable Ability Possible? I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Kathleen Stevenson. We're going to go out with some music by Sting. Thanks for listening.
When the angels fall, shine. I'd love to wander back.
Hi there. This is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Daphne Miller, is a Harvard-trained physician and a professor of family medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Her widely acclaimed first book, The Jungle Effect, chronicled her nutrition adventures as she traveled to traditional communities around the world. And she returns to Health Watch today to talk about her second book, entitled Pharmacology with an F, Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. Welcome back to Health Watch, Dr. Daphne Miller.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, for people who aren't familiar with your first book, The Jungle Effect, maybe we can just start with how you first became interested in food and in relationship to medicine and health.
Absolutely. I'm a family doctor. In fact, today I'm talking to you in between patients. And when you begin to practice medicine in the real world after finishing your medical training, you suddenly